Welcome to SCOTUscast, Statutory Interpretation and Federal Exchanges Under the Affordable Care Act Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 4, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in King v. Burwell. The question in this highly anticipated case is whether the Affordable Care Act authorizes the Internal Revenue Service to offer tax credit subsidies for individuals purchasing health insurance through federal exchanges. To discuss the case, we have Professor Jonathan Adler, who is the Johann Verhey Memorial Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Adler.
It's a pleasure to be here to talk about King versus Burwell, the third case heard by the Supreme Court concerning the Affordable Care Act since that law's passage. As I think everyone knows, the court initially heard a frontal constitutional challenge to the Affordable Care Act in NFIB versus Sebelius, in which the court upheld the penalty of the individual mandate as a tax, but held that the mandate could not be justified under the commerce power and that new Medicaid money could not be constitutionally conditioned, old Medicaid money could not be constitutionally conditioned on the acceptance of the new Medicaid expansion. The court considered the Affordable Care Act again in the Hobby Lobby case, where it looked at how the implementation of that law intersected with statutes that provide for the protection of religious exercise and religious freedom. And then today we have the Affordable Care Act's third trip to the Supreme Court, in which the court is looking at how the IRS is implementing provisions of the statute that concern the operation of exchanges in which consumers in the individual market may purchase health insurance. The key issue in the case is whether or not the IRS acted consistent with the law when it issued a regulation saying that individuals who purchase qualifying health insurance in exchanges established by the federal government may receive tax credits under the Act. The reason this is a legal issue is because the relevant provision of the law in Section 1401 authorizes tax credits for the purchase of qualifying health insurance in an exchange established by the state under Section 1311. The IRS's position is that even though the language of the statutory provision says established by a state under Section 1311, that an exchange established by the Department of Health and Human Services under Section 1321 qualifies and can be the locus of a health insurance purchase that is eligible for tax credits. This is an issue that has divided lower courts. This case is an appeal from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, which had held that the statute is sufficiently ambiguous that it would defer to the IRS's interpretation and thereby upheld the rule. On the same day as that decision had come out, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit had held the opposite. It held that the IRS rule was impermissible under the law because the statute only authorizes tax credits for the purchases of health insurance in an exchange established by the state, and the Department of Health and Human Services is not a state. State, incidentally, is defined in the statute as one of the 50 states and the District of Columbia. There were also cases filed in district courts, and one of those in Oklahoma did reach a final judgment, and there the district court in Oklahoma agreed with the D.C. Circuit, holding that the IRS rule was unconstitutional. The D.C. Circuit decision was subject to a petition for en banc rehearing from the federal government that was initially granted. Rather than wait for the disposition of that, the plaintiffs in the Virginia litigation filed a petition for certiorari in that case, which the court accepted, and so that was the case that was argued today. To say at the outset, in terms of the oral argument today, the justices were very attentive and engaged in the oral argument. You could certainly see that they were listening very carefully to the questions at issue. It was a fairly active bench, a lot of justices asking quite a few questions. Initially, right off the bat, Justice Ginsburg raised questions about standing. This is something that had gotten a lot of attention in the press, whether or not one or more of the plaintiffs in the case had taken actions or had changes in their lives that would mean they no longer had standing to bring this case. That's an important question, because if no plaintiff has standing, then the court will be deprived of Article III jurisdiction. That really didn't seem to go very far. Michael Carvin, who was arguing for the plaintiffs, explained, as we know, that only one of the plaintiffs needs to have standing for there to be jurisdiction, and explained why at least two of the plaintiffs would still have standing under the theories of standing that had been recognized by the lower courts. The Solicitor General did not really dispute that, asked to address standing at the beginning of his argument. Don Varelli pretty much just laid out what the relevant legal tests would be and what factual showings would need to be made, but also said that he had heard nothing from the plaintiffs that would make him believe that the court lacked jurisdiction, and so his assumption was that they had standing and the court had jurisdiction. And the Solicitor General's office really did not take the opportunity to pursue that line of argument, suggesting, I think, that they realized that's not a basis upon which they could win, and that it's almost certain that at least one of the four plaintiffs has standing. In terms of the substance, Michael Carvin was certainly challenged quite a bit on statutory language. Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan were very aggressive, but I think he ably held his own, and it did not seem that any of the conservative justices or either of the justices who were potential swing justices, that being the Chief Justice and Justice Kennedy, it did not seem that either of them were particularly persuaded by the textual arguments made on the government's behalf. The Solicitor General, for his part, was asked to explain why the language of the statute reads as it does. Why does it say established by the state instead of established in the state or for the state, or perhaps just to simply say generic reference to exchange? And he didn't really have a good argument for why that would be, about why Congress would adopt this awkward phrasing. And even at one point, I think, misstated the drafting history of the language in question, suggesting that this language is really language that completely dated from the Senate Finance Committee, whereas we know that one of the references to exchanges established by the state in the relevant provision was added very late in the process under a lot of time pressure in the Senate Majority Leader's office, and that's discussed in the amicus brief that I submitted along with Michael Cannon, discussing some of our research on this case. On questions of whether or not the statute was potentially ambiguous, there were some interesting questions about that. The reason this matters is because if the court were to conclude that the statutory language is ambiguous, then we would normally think that this would mean that the court should defer to the agency's interpretation, provided that interpretation is reasonable. What's interesting is that Justice Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts both expressed some skepticism about both whether there's ambiguity but more importantly, what the implications of that would be. Justice Kennedy asked whether a conflict within the statute itself should be seen as a source of ambiguity. The Solicitor General said yes, but it is worth noting that last term, in a case in which the court was confronted with that question, a majority of the justices concluded that conflict in statutory provisions was not ambiguity for purposes of Chevron, because it would not be evidence that Congress meant to delegate the interpretive question to the agency. And Justice Kennedy responded as well that he thought it would be, in his words, a drastic step to conclude that Congress had delegated something as momentous as whether or not tax credits would exist in federal exchanges to the IRS. That is the sort of thing that Congress would not lied over. That would be the sort of thing that Congress would have been clear about. And the Chief Justice then asked whether or not, if the court were to decide at Chevron Step 2, would that not mean that a future administration could reverse course? And of course, the answer to that is yes. The court's precedent is quite clear that agencies may change their interpretations of statutes under Chevron Step 2 over time, and that they may change their interpretations with changes in administration. One issue that's a wild card in this litigation, and it's one that has started to get a lot of press and is addressed quite a bit by amicus briefs, but not nearly so much by the merits brief by the plaintiffs or the government, is how federalism concerns should influence the interpretation of the statute. There was a lot of interest in this. It was raised early on by Justice Sotomayor, for example, and a lot of people think that federalism concerns are a possible way that either Justice Kennedy and or the Chief Justice might be convinced to side with the federal government. A couple observations about that. One is those federalism arguments got explicated in the argument. I think it became clear that for the court to conclude that conditioning the availability of tax credits on state cooperation raises problematic federalism concerns, the court would have to implicitly or explicitly shift federalism doctrine quite dramatically, because the court has upheld statutes under which Congress has imposed quite serious consequences on private parties in uncooperating states. And the court has had no problem upholding such arrangements in the past. So to suggest that the plaintiff's interpretation of the statute here is problematic would certainly shift the doctrine in that direction. Justice Alito also pointed out on the question of notice, that is, whether or not federalism requires that states are put on adequate notice of the conditions in a statute, that the way these provisions work is that insofar as states didn't have notice, it's because of the IRS rule, but that were the court to side with the plaintiffs, states would then have the chance, and that what the notice requirement is about is making sure that states understand the conditions they are accepting when they make their choice. And Justice Alito, I think, ably illustrated why there's no problem here. If the court were to side with the plaintiffs, states would have the opportunity to decide whether or not they want to create exchanges, and they would know what the conditions were of that choice. And so, and I think that addressed that concern. One other issue that came up, which is also not discussed all that much in the briefing, is related to remedy. Justice Alito raised the question of whether or not the court could, for example, stay the mandate until the end of the year to make clear that any decision would not take effect until the next tax year, to allow for an easier transition, to allow for states to make a choice about whether or not to create exchanges. And Justice Alito pointed out that the court had done that before, and the Solicitor General really had no objection to that or argument to that. The Solicitor General noted that the situation here is arguably slightly different because federal expenditures are involved, but certainly noted that the court could do that, and that something like that would ease the transition. So I think that was also interesting, particularly because the briefing by the parties really did not focus very much on remedy questions. So those are some observations from the oral argument.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.